This is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, we've all heard the phrase, necessity is the mother of invention. But successful innovators recognize that many times just the opposite is true. Invention is the mother of necessity. Here's an example. Think of the iPod. Whoever asked the iPod, do we need to have an iPod? Hey, I wish we, you know, somebody should invent the iPod. It was the ingenious people at Apple who created it as part of a system that meshes with the way people actually listen to music. Apple's Better Mousetrap quickly became a must-have for serious music fans. Bye-bye, Walkman. While the myopic recording industry was busy suing Napster and stalking prepubescent downloaders. So you had the iPod. That created the necessity of all the other stuff people had to have. So what is it that makes some people think outside the box while the rest of us are content to just color inside the lines? Why is it also that some companies are so good at fostering new ideas and new innovation, and some companies, they shun from any new ideas and shun any innovation, and they don't want to hear anything about it? Well, Evan Schwartz calls it juice, and he's written a book about people who have it, people like Leroy Hood, inventor of the DNA sequencer, Dean Kamen, who gave us the Segway, and Max Levchin of PayPal fame. His list of innovative geniuses includes one of our guests this hour, the inventor of the light-emitting diode. So if you'd like to join our conversation and talk about innovation, give us a call. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce both my guests. Evan Schwartz is a contributing writer for MIT's Technology Review, a former editor at Business Week, and also the new book, Juice, the creative fuel that drives world-class inventors. And it's from the Harvard Business School Press. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. Pleasure to be here.
Nick Holoniak is the John Bardeen Endowed Chair Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering and Physics at the University of Illinois. And as an engineer at GE in the late 1950s, he invented a device romantics still give thanks for, which is the dimmer switch. You know, that little switch on the wall socket there? You dim the lights up and down. That was a long time ago. And in 1962, he created the infinitely more useful, depends on who you ask, I guess, a light-emitting diode, or the LED that, you know, you can find now in computer screens and flashlights. And it's sort of an innovation that is beginning to finally show fruit. And later in the show, I think he'll tell us how much energy you can actually save. We can all save this time of the year if we replace all those Christmas tree bulbs with LEDs. Welcome, Nick, to the program.
Good afternoon, everybody.
Evan, what is juice? So you named juice. Is that like the driving energy that these people have?
Yeah, it's your creative energy. Every brain produces 20 watts of electricity if you could actually wire it up to a light bulb. And it's how we channel it. And invention is fun, but it's also subversive, and it's also addictive. Inventors have to keep inventing. Once they're successful at it, they have to keep going, and it's what gets their adrenaline flowing. Mm-hmm. So I call it juice, and it's creative energy. And what you mentioned before about seeing opportunities, how invention is the mother of necessity, is really what these people do. They create these opportunities in their minds. You know, who would have thought we needed a dimmer switch or an LED? People weren't standing around demanding them. And as you mentioned, the iPod is another example. And if you go back to the telephone, people were just not demanding it. In fact, they were fighting against it when it was introduced. So it's this one of the thinking strategies is to create these new opportunities in your mind.
Nick, when you invented the LED, as Evan was saying, were you dissatisfied with a light bulb?
Well, not particularly. I told Evan and I have had plenty of opportunity to talk about some of these things before, and I'm a person out of the transistor field, and transistors are a certain class of materials, and those materials are mainly for electronic purposes, for example, the switch, and for chips, integrated circuits, and that kind of thing. But as you get into that, you find out that not only do you deal with electrical phenomena, you're dealing with optical phenomena, photons. And somewhere along the way in trying to build these electrical devices, I went off in a direction where I found myself looking at light coming out of a semiconductor. And as I saw more and more light, then I started to get intrigued with where that light might be for human use.
Mm-hmm. And did your lab there encourage you to continue with that line of?
Well, not really. Some of that work was sort of bootlegged. Some of it was supported by military contracts where people were a little bit more liberal about looking in further out. But my boss actually wanted me to work more in the electrical domain and not in the so-called optical domain where you're dealing with more exotic materials. And so at the time, I bootlegged some of my work. He knew that I was doing some other work, but he didn't know what fraction of time I was doing other things. And if it turns out I had been unsuccessful, at one point he put me under threat that I could essentially hit the road.
You know, this is true of a lot of geniuses and a lot of innovations. You know, Alexander Graham Bell's father-in-law, who was his benefactor, forbid him to work on the telephone because he thought there wasn't a penny to be made on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And your stories and other stories of people, you know, there's an old story of Einstein. It's almost like this, where he worked in the patent office on his theories of relativity and he had, you know, look around, pull out his theory, write it on paper, put it away again. But it seems like geniuses find a way to get it to happen, right? Inventors who have the juice find a way to make it work.
Well, I think Evans captured that in his book, the fact that once you're into anything involving invention or innovation or so forth, and you learn that you can do that kind of stuff, you're going to do it. You're going to do it no matter what, and you'll find some way around whatever the problems are.
Nick, you tell the story back in 1962 at GE, you could have possibly even gotten fired for working on this subversive project, an LED, when you were supposed to be doing something else, right?
Yes, because, you see, as far as bosses are concerned, there's more pressure on them for something else. And if you're looking further out for some reason or another, or your curiosity is taking you in some direction that's not in line with the main goal, then you're in jeopardy that the hierarchy is going to remove you. Or drop you.
Yeah, it's one of those tough issues in how do companies innovate if they don't know what the market needs. But, you know, one of the thinking strategies we've talked about that you've always used is applying analogies, right? How the vacuum tube is somewhat analogous to the transistor. Or if you even go back in history, like Gutenberg, he knew about movable type, but the way he got the idea for the printing presses at a wine party when he saw how a wine press worked, and he applied that analogy of pressing and pressing paper, and that's how the printing press eventually was put into operation. Can you talk a little bit about that, how the analogy of the vacuum tube and other things helped you?
Yes, but let me insert something, Evan. I don't think when we were talking I told you about hunting rabbits when I was a kid in a depression in southern Illinois in the coal fields. And a rabbit will jump up and run and try to get around you, but then it has a habit of circling back. And what a lot of us are doing when we're inventing is we're doing the same thing. That is, we're circling back into our pool of knowledge. You, as you're going through life and learning certain things, you're essentially building some sort of a toolbox. And you keep coming back into that box to reach in there to grab things that you need. And you see, I'm working on transistors, but I'm learning a lot of the things that I need to work in other areas that I can spin out into, and then I can go back into that pile of material that I've been assembling and reach in there and grab out some more stuff that I need. And so I'm not using always new information. I'm using information that somehow or another I've stored along the way. Maybe like a squirrel storing nuts. You're a junk collector, but you're an intellectual junk collector. And you tend to work out of an area where you have either knowledge or ability or experience. You don't just jump into deep water somewhere where you don't know anything. You might if you have some special knowledge that is going to open up some direction for you, but you don't just jump in where everything is empty.
And where does it come from? I mean, a lot of the inventors I interviewed for the book essentially said it came from when they were kids and they were taking apart radios and fixing cars, and it's this compulsion to create that they got since they were kids. And you talk a little bit about that when you were a kid.
I agree, because I grew up in an immigrant community where people were, I didn't know it, but they were poor. And they were used to making many of the things they needed. If a screen door broke, you took it off the hinges, went to the hardware store, got some wire, and nailed on some new wire and so forth. And so I saw them doing for themselves. And I learned, particularly from my godfather, how to do things like that. And at some point, even before I was in kindergarten or around that time, my dad handed me a knife, and he said in his language, here, learn how to make things for yourself. And so little by little, I found myself doing for myself. During the Depression, we didn't go to various places and buy toys. We made our toys.
This is very much the Thomas Edison method of brute force trying ideas out until you find one that works. What about the fact that, did you actually visualize things in advance? That can you see them and just wait for the right moment to happen?
Yes, I think all the people that I experience in the kind of things that I do can visualize what they're doing and can visualize where they're going to go with something they're working on. Even I noticed there was a very good machinist that would make some parts for me here while I've been at the university, and I could see that frequently he was working in the same manner. That is, he could see ahead of time, just from some descriptive material, what we were going to have to put together, how we were going to have to do that. You do envision what you're going to do. You see it in your mind. And sometimes, of course, you begin to draw it on paper. And one benefit of going into higher education is, of course, you develop some powerful methods and use some scientific and technical methods to aid you with your vision. But you're always visualizing.
Mm-hmm. And the ability to carry through on your visualization.
Back in that toolbox to get in there to use the material that you know about that can help you do a problem.
Evan, do inventors have individual styles like artists do? You know,
So. I think they put their own mark and they have their own little toolbox that they use, and you could almost see their signature inventions. It also depends on what kind of mentors you have. I mean, if you when I first met Nick, it's when he won the Lemelson MIT Award early this year. And in Washington, D.C. at the ceremony, and he was telling me about his mentor, John Bardeen, and that kind of experience and what effect it had on him. And I'm sure Nick would love to talk about that.
Two Nobel Prizes, Evan, John Bardeen won.
You hit a key thing. Somewhere fairly early in my life, I learned to separate out. For example, some of the kids in the coal fields who were having problems in school would say to me, I hate school, don't you? And I would go along with them so that they think I'm agreeing with them, but that's not what I really thought, because that's not what we thought at home. In other words, I could make a distinction between who I believed in and who I didn't believe in, and who was a good teacher and who was a poor teacher and that type of thing. And, of course, when Bardeen came here from Bell Labs in 1951, I took an atomic physics course from him. And I didn't notice something that the other students complained about later, that John mumbled and he wasn't a loquacious kind of a teacher, but I was fascinated by what he was doing, and I locked in right away on John the thinker, and I wanted to see why he was thinking and going in a certain direction rather than some other direction. And I could see right away that this man works at a different level, different manner than the people I was used to seeing before him. And later at meetings, I know right away that I want to hear the paper from this particular speaker and not that other speaker, because certain people are capable of victimizing you because of how good they are and how clever they are.
Hold that thought, because we'll come back and talk with you. We have to take a break, talking with Evan Schwartz, author of Juice, the Creative Fuel that Drives World-Class Inventors, and Nick Holoniak. So stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about invention, the innovative process, with my guest Evan Schwartz, author of a great new book called Juice, the Creative Fuel that Drives World-Class Inventors, and an inventor himself, Nick Holoniak, the man behind the LED and also the light dimmer. 1-800-989-8255. And just so you should know, Nick, that when I was studying electrical engineering in college in the late 60s, the light dimmer was my class project. I had no idea, you know, that I'd be talking to you about this any day.
Well, the idea of making a light dimmer circuit wasn't mine. The idea of making that device was mine. So it turns out that you're somehow or another getting help by someone else also when you're inventing.
Well, very kind of you to say those things. Evan, let's talk a bit about the first step toward harnessing your inner inventor. And you're right that you have to stop thinking like a consumer.
That's right.
Why is that?
Well, it's appropriate to talk about this around the holiday season when we're all giving presents. But we are trained since kids to look at things like, what do I want? Do I want that? Is that brand good for me? And inventors look at the world completely differently. They think, why does that work? How can I make that obsolete? What's wrong with that thing? Why can't I make that better? And when you start thinking like that, you're approaching the world in a different way. You know, you start thinking, you're creating essentially a what-if machine in your mind, just like Dr. Hubert J. Farnsworth, the fictional professor on the Matt Groening TV series Futurama. He created this what-if machine, and they would invent, you know, tables that do your dishes or car keys that never get lost or whatever you could come up with. And that's how invention starts. And it's not easy to come up with something that people would need once you start doing it. But once you play this invention game and keep thinking that way, it really and get addicted to it and come up with great ideas, this energy is what drives you forward. And that's what all these inventors have in common. And they can't stop doing it.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones to Mary in Mesa, Arizona. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thank you for the show. Women need role models, so I'd like for you to say a few things about Stephanie Kwolek, who invented the Kevlar, who is her product is in more and more use in the war and the airplanes and then bulletproof jackets and so on.
There have been a lot of women inventors.
Yes, I know not that many, as many as men, but women do need role models, and they need to be exposed more to these things.
That's right.
They do have the creativity that men have, but they use most of the creativity to manipulate men.
That's right.
Not all of them.
Evan, you want to comment? I noticed there's not a whole lot of women inventors.
Well, it's true.
I would like to hear some comments about her way of inventing.
Stephanie Kwolek. She's a great example, and she was working for a corporate research laboratory when she came up with Kevlar. And there are also great examples throughout history. Madame Curie and all kinds of great
scientists.
Hedy Lamarr was an inventor, worked on some of the early cell phone stuff, but not intentionally. Mm-hmm. And there are some great inventors today. One of them who I profile is Catherine Guarini at IBM, who's developing three-dimensional microprocessors, and an inventor named Amy Smith at MIT who's inventing for third world countries where places they don't necessarily have electricity. And she's inventing all kinds of farming tools and medical tools. So it's
Evan,
true.
You're forgetting Edith Flanagan. When we met in April in Washington at the Lemelson MIT Prize ceremony, there was Edith Flanagan there. And Edith is roughly my age and is a well-known inventor. She's in the Inventors Hall of Fame. And when Edith and I compared notes in our youth, we found we were agreeing with essentially what you said about something starting very early in your life that as a child, your curiosity drives you and leads you and goads you and supplies you with the energy. And Edith had a different background than mine, but the same one in the sense that she was using her curiosity very early in her life and then became a chemist and then became a famous inventor inventing molecular sieves. Now, people won't know what that does, but that'll extract moisture out of gases, or you could use it to refine oil and make gasolines and so forth. Edith's work is phenomenal, and she's a recognized inventor and a Hall of Fame inventor. There are plenty of women here and there, but it's hard for us to know all of them because we all are doing something else.
Well, we're glamorizing Madonna instead of people who really do hard work and change the course of history.
Right.
Yeah. Nothing against Madonna, but just as an example about celebrity is now very important, and we don't have a way yet to bring science into the celebrity field.
That's right. And, you know, it used to be inventors were the ultimate heroes. Right. Edison, during his day, was the most admired person in the world. The Wright brothers, Bell. And inventors today, if they're famous, tend to be fictional characters. Like in The Incredibles, there was an evil genius kid who invented these destructive robots. And we don't have as many of those role models today.
Let's go to the phones, 1-800-989-8255. Frank in Utah. Hi, Frank.
How are you today?
Hi, how are you?
I was intrigued when you talked about at the beginning about thinking outside the box as opposed to in the line. And my thought went to, and perhaps the author of Juice could help with this, how you keep from ossifying. There's a company here, Franklin, that came up with the Day Planner, got hugely successful, merged with Stephen Covey, and while everybody else was coming out with PDAs, basically just went belly up because they kept making paper day planners. And, you know, for an organization that was lauded as being front-running and forward-thinking and outside the box, they ended up coloring inside the lines. So from an organizational standpoint, how does one retain or keep that juice from getting ossified?
Well, that's a good question, and one way to do it is to give a group of people at your company complete freedom to work on any problems they want, even if it has nothing to do with the company. For instance, at Google, you get one day a week, 20% of your time, to work on your own personal projects. So you're being paid not to do your work. But they bring it in that all the employees rate their projects in a top 100 list, and eventually they could be brought out. And some of the things have been, like the frugal shopping service and a lot of community features on Google. And I think that's the way to do it, to really pay people to just not do their work and be free. And almost like the Bell Labs model years ago, where that was happening, and those giant research labs are, you know, under a lot of pressure to work on germane projects.
Right. They have to come up with a blockbuster item now.
Yeah, exactly.
So how did Apple hit with the iPod and no one else saw this coming?
Well, it was really one of the strategies I write about is thinking systematically. Invention is not just one idea. It's many, many ideas. And, you know, the iPod's not just a little gadget with the tiny hard drive. It's a whole system, and the iTunes software is part of it, and the relationships with the record companies, and the whole way you pay and download music. And it's just many, many ideas. And all the accessories that you could turn this thing into stereo system.
You know, it's very much like Edison and the light bulb, because to invent the light bulb, we had to invent the wires, the transformers, the power generators, the whole system.
Exactly. He had to electrify an entire city before a light bulb was useful.
You have to have malcontents to a certain extent in your organization and youth, too. In other words, if you become too ossified, too staid, too old, you begin to do everything the old way, and you don't look at anything new. The Google founders, if you look at them, were a couple of young guys that were barely past being graduate students.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's no end of things where you need that young mind to come in and push the old people a little bit and to bother them.
And the Google people didn't work for anybody, did they? I mean, if they had the idea and working inside another company and said, hey, we're going to make a web browser that searches for stuff, they might have said, okay, next idea.
That's right. They were working at a university where at Stanford, where there are grad students and where a lot of our innovation is coming from now, and almost taking the place of the big corporate labs. We have places like Stanford and MIT doing that kind of work. But another thing is the willingness to fail and embracing failure and encouraging failure and using that as a learning opportunity. Dean Kamen talks about that all the time, that you have to keep making mistakes as fast as possible in order to eventually succeed.
But if you're the head of your own company like Dean Kamen is, or the Google people, or Steve Jobs at Apple, people like that, you're the originator of the ideas in your company. You don't have to justify it maybe to your stockholders and your board a little bit, but you don't have to justify it to your uppers because you are the uppers.
That's right.
You're ready to take the chance, and you're willing to.
Yeah, and that's very unusual to have someone so innovative at the head of a company like Apple Computer.
I used to know an innovator, an inventor named Jacob Rabinow. I don't know if that name is familiar.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
He had 300 patents or something like that. And he used to tell me all the time of all the failures he had. Not that his patents didn't work, but he could not convince people in these giant companies to ever invest in any of his patents. And he wound up going to Europe for many of the patents that turned into big bonanzas.
Yeah, and Edison said, I invented 1,000 different ways not to make a light bulb work. So it's that kind of thing that moves you forward.
A Xerox machine, you had to talk people into the Xerox machine, that kinds of stuff. But people just didn't get it.
Exactly, and I think that's the mark of a real breakthrough idea, things that surprise people and you don't mm-hmm. understand it at first. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of it's accidental, but there's a misnomer, a misconception about accidental inventions also. You know, if you look at classic cases like Goodyear leaving a piece of rubber on the stove and it got singed, and that was vulcanized rubber led to the tire. But he was waiting for that accident to happen for years.
But good. I'm glad you brought him up. But he died a penniless pauper, didn't he? Because he didn't know how to make money on his invention.
He didn't. He was a little ahead of his time. It was, I think, the 1840s he was working, and it wasn't until the bicycle craze in the 1880s that they needed these tires.
And they bring that up because I know lots of people who are inventors. But they make the mistake of thinking that they're businessmen, too. And they may have an invention, but they're so fearful that someone's going to steal the idea, or that if they bring a business partner in with them that they're going to lose their market share or their intellectual property. And by the time anything happens, their invention is obsolete. Something else has come along.
Yeah, that's true. A lot of inventors make the mistake, and very few are good at both, at invention and business. So it's almost always a good idea to bring in those professionals to bring it to market and get to your next invention. You know, that's what it's all about.
You've hit accidentally on the business of Edison, and also you didn't mention Tesla. And see, Tesla didn't wind up. And, well, I doubt if many Americans even know who Tesla happened to be. But here he was, the person that invented AC and got AC current working, and was opposed to and arguing with Edison about such matters. Edison became rich enough to run a laboratory. Tesla essentially died very well known to those of us that know anything about electrical science, but very unknown to the general public, and died essentially a poor man.
An unsung hero. We're talking about inventors this hour in Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News with Evan Schwartz, author of Juice, the Creative Fuel that Drives World-Class Inventors, and also Nick Holoniak, who invented the LED, the dimmer switch. How many projects have you worked at? You worked at Bell Labs on the...
Well, I worked at Bell Labs on the early silicon technology. I was in John Maul's group, and it was from John Maul's group that Bell Labs shipped the information to Shockley that was carried to the West Coast. And then later in my life, when I was doing the stuff related to the dimmer switch, I ran into a patent interference with Bob Noyce, the founder, the man who was the leader of the group that went from Shockley to Fairchild and then formed Intel. Actually, as far as what I've worked on a lot of different things, some of them technical that don't look like they're part of a product but are inside of a product. There are some things in lasers, in semiconductor lasers, that have actually earned some money, but they're buried inside of a laser. Mm-hmm. And right now we're working on a transistor, which is simultaneously a laser, and who knows where that's going to go. I don't know if I'm going to live long enough to see where the various things go ultimately.
And can you predict? I mean, we're talking about innovations that no one could see. Can you predict where innovations are going to head?
Well, yes and no. In 1962, when I was working on these artificial crystals that would emit red light, one of those experiments led to a red laser, the first visible spectrum semiconductor laser, diode laser. And I knew right away then that, I have the basic ingredients now for a light-emitting diode. But I couldn't tell then how much time would be required to get it to the point where you see it today. And look, what's gone by, 40 years. But I did say to an editor of Reader's Digest back about, 42 years ago, I told him that from this I could envision that there would be a visible spectrum white LED, and today there is such a thing. In other words, I didn't know exactly the path that we would travel to get there, but I could see enough already to know that it's going to happen.
Right, speaking, we only have a couple of minutes left. Did you come up with a figure? That I promised this at the beginning of the show. If we replaced all the Christmas lights with LEDs, how much power would we save?
Well, I don't have that figure, but my colleague on the West Coast, George Crawford, who's been the leader now in doing this, wrote a statement or prepared a statement for an editor that there would be, if we could just replace incandescents now with LEDs, we'd save $17 billion a year in energy costs, or the equivalent of 30 power plants. Or we would reduce polluting emissions by 155 million tons annually. In other words, the incandescent market now is $12 to $15 billion, and the LED market is under $3 billion. But the LED market is, the LEDs are climbing in and beginning to take some of that market.
And they're already starting to replace Christmas tree lights. I think the Department of Energy that said if we did replace all Christmas tree lights with LEDs, we would have enough energy to power 200,000 homes for an entire year. And that's just a very small application for a few weeks a year. So if you multiply that by every bulb, would you predict that one day we're going to replace incandescent bulbs?
Oh, the incandescent bulb is doomed. I made that statement 10 years ago in Japan and pointed to the ceiling and said, all of this is going to go. And it is. It's just going to take some time to do it.
It may go through fluorescent first.
Yes.
Because they're very efficient, and it was hard enough to find them around anywhere. I want to thank both of you for taking time to join with us today. Nick, I want to wish you Merry Christmas, a Happy New Year.
Thank you, and likewise to you and Evan.
Thanks. Happy holidays, Nick.
Nick Olenyak is the John Bardeen Endowed Chair Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering and Physics at the University of Illinois. And also with me is Evan Schwartz, contributing writer for MIT's Technology Review, former editor at Business Week. And his new book, which I highly recommend if you need a last-minute gift, Juice, the creative fuel that drives world-class inventors, out from Harvard Business School Press. Have a happy holiday to you, too.
Thank you, Ira. You too.
We're going to take a quick break and come back and talk about an illness, celiac disease, that you may have and not even know it. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday from NPR News.